Good evening. This is KQRIW. And at this time, we begin the TechNet. A person signs into the TechNet by giving L, K2YE. Sorry about the K2KEY. And Tech, K2RIW, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name.
This is KT2QIW. The name is Jeff.
Hold traffic, Dick. Hold traffic.
KC2RGW, no traffic. Name is Chris.
KC2OES, no traffic. Name is Fred.
This is WC2C, and yes, I have a question.
WJ2BS.
Okay, so far we've got Joe with a yes, Chris with a no, Eugene I think with a no, Fred with a no, WC2C with a yes, WJ2B with a yes. Did I miss anybody and anyone else?
KC2, QIQ, and a no.
KQJHR mobile, no.
WB7ACF, no.
Okay, we got Gwen with a no, JHR with a no, and WB7 with a no. Anyone else? Okay, let's start off with Joe. KT2QIW. Joe, what would you like to discuss tonight?
Yes, this is KT2QIW for ID. I just wanted to say hi to the net. And, yeah, I guess I have a question. Alright, if the radio just came out this year in production, I guess, is it always good to wait like maybe 2 or 3 years down the road? It might go down in price. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a good one. There are people who don't want to buy the radio when it first comes out for fear that they're buying serial number one. And sometimes serial number one has still got a couple of bugs in it. And by the time you get to the second or third production run, the bugs go away. That's one approach. As far as the price coming down, I guess they all do. But then you've got to ask yourself the question, if it comes down 20% in price, and you save $50, but you have to wait a year, and so for a year you didn't have the use of that particular rig that you like, then were you willing to pay $50 for that particular year of use? There's more variables involved. Let's see if Mel's got an opinion on that one. Mel, among your guys, when a new radio comes out, and they'd love to get the one with the new horns and whistles, do they buy it right away? Do they wait a month? Do they wait 6 months? What do most of the guys in the Kings County Radio Club do? K2KEY, if you're there, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and good evening to all. First of all, let me wish everybody a Merry Christmas on frequency. And, well, suggestion I give, don't jump, because a lot of times these radios, when they come out, and then you start reading the feedback from the ham, the manufacturer usually takes it into consideration of what he has to do to modify it and come out with mark number two. And the best example of this was some years ago, they came out with the, ICOM came out with the 706. And the 706, initially, it did have some problems here and there. Not too much, nothing too major. But they surely did correct a lot of different situations and came out with the, what they call the Mark II. And other radios, instead of just, you know, just coming out with you know, like I could say something like the Mark II or something, they actually did re-engineer some of them and really came out with another model number. But if you look through a lot of the radios, they went through a lot of changes We in fact, we're just discussing that this morning on the 10-meter net. Particular radio, the ACE to ST-1000, started out with 1000, they went through a number of them, they came out with the field version, and then the last of them was the Mark V version. So, what do you get? Well, I just say subtle problems, some of them very subtle, are corrected. In other cases, some major problems. There have been some with major problems. And unfortunately, the people that get those original models had the choice either trade them in and pay the difference for the new model, because, you know, soon you receive it, open the box, it's going to depreciate a certain amount of money. And the hams usually get pretty savvy, because today with the internet, there are a number of places you can go to see the feedback on any particular rig. And if it's not favorable, believe me, the manufacturer's going to take note of it. Because in many cases, it's either not going to be purchased or be, you know, go back to the dealer. And the dealers today are pretty cooperative with the hams, because they know one thing, it's a small industry, you know, it's a small amateur radio, only represents a very small percentage of the electronic sales. So if you're in a business to sell amateur radio equipment, and you're going to come up with, you know, situations that you don't, you know, meet the ham at least halfway or better, you're going to get, the word will go out real quick, stay away from so-and-so, don't deal with them. He's, you know, not an easy person to deal with. But, you know, your business will go downhill quickly if the word does spread. I could say amateur radio being a small community in comparison to the electronics field, the word gets around pretty quick. And today, again, with the internet, you can well imagine that it covers quite a bit, extremely fast of the world of amateur radio. So the word to the wise is, I'd wait a bit of time. There are always radios out that are compatible, you know, that have already been on the market and proven. And so either go with one of them or just wait a period of time to make sure that you're not buying something that has some problems in it that's going to make you very unhappy. Back to you, Dick.
You have a very rough approximation as to what's the right rating time for a brand new rig, Mel. Are we talking about 3 months, 6 months, a year? Do you have a rough approximation? Of course it's going to be different for each radio, but is there any kind of an average you know of that the smarter guys in your group tend to wait?
No, I'll tell you, a lot of the guys are waiting to see the review in QST. They usually do a pretty good job of reviewing it. And they actually not only review the radio as to the manufacturer specifications, but also the ARRL lab in recent years have really, you know, come up in the world as to be able to evaluate and compare, you know, give you a comparison, AB comparison between the manufacturers and the ARRL lab. And plus, they also now, I see, that's one of the people at the ARRL that is, you know, specialist in whatever particular radio, whether it's for HF or VHF or UHF, you know, that really is into that particular portion of the hobby. Take it and actually use it and get the final comment. Usually they have the bottom line at the end of the article every month after the review gets over.
Okay. Good sounding suggestion. I'm going to pass it back to Joe, the man who asked the original question. And Joe's going to delay for a couple of seconds just to see if anyone else wants to add their comments to what they believe is the right waiting time when a brand new rig comes out before you buy one. KC2 QIW with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the tech net.
N2RRA, I guess we'll throw a consensus.
N2RRA. Start off with your name, sir, and then we'd love to hear your comments. My name is Dick.
K2RIW, good evening, Dick, good evening, everyone. N2RRA, name is Eric, and we're based out of White Plains, New York. And I guess a quick 2 cents, and I personally wait 6 months. I wait as much as 6 months. I look at making an investment a very important thing. Obviously, you don't want to throw your money away. For example, the ICOM 7000, I waited several months before I decided on purchasing it. Same as the 746, the first generation 746, and still is a great radio, although the 746 Pro, you would think that would not have any problems, but they did have I believe it's the IC-151 recall on the 746 Pros, but because everyone thought the 746 version was such an outstanding radio that it would be almost impossible that the second generation 746 Pro series would not have any issues, although obviously many were proven wrong. So I generally wait 6 months. I think it takes QSC a few months anyway, or anywhere else to really do very in-depth reviews. I like the proof in the pudding, word of mouth. Although QSC does a very good job and is very honest and everything, in terms of advertisement or articles in various magazines, we look to see what the consensus say out there, for the most part. We ensure that we're not swallowed by any hype, by any means. 6 months is what I wait, by doing that, I don't think I've had any problems. Another example is the Diesel 9000. Everybody ran off to buy the Diesel 9000 and wound up being a flop, just as well as the SP2000. Many, many problems with those radios. But before you make an investment of $800, $1,500, $10,000, 6 months for me, preferably, has always been a good starting point. By doing that, I've made a lot of wise decisions. Back to you. Get to RIW. Back to RI.
Very fine, Eric. A buddy of mine was so enthusiastic about the FT2000 that he didn't buy one of them. He bought two of them. He's using them as tunable IFs and things like this on his VHF-UHF converters. He has discovered that the 432 input seems to have a rather high noise figure, as many Southeast Asia made rigs do. If you don't put a preamp in front of them, they're a little bit on the dead side. They're a little bit gain solved because of emphasizing high dynamic range as opposed to a weak signal reception. I'm kind of curious, Eric, what specific problems have you heard of with the FT2000 into RRA, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
K2RIW and 2RRA. Generally speaking, I've been running HF quite some time, and although there seems to be an improvement on floor noise and machine sensitivity over the FT1000 Mark 5 and Mark 5 field, what I hear is they generally run into somewhat of an overheating problem. Overheating issue, and not many radios in production, but in some of the receive just goes out. I'm not quite sure technically why or what section of the radio there's a failure in, but receive goes out, and there's a high number in transmit going out in the FT2000, but the same problem that's in the FT2000 seems to be as well in the 9000, their $10,000 flagship radio. That radio in particular, when it's working, is a superb fine radio, although the transmit has a serious transmit problem. It can work for you for 2 weeks and then completely go kaput. I know one guy who is, a dedicated Diesel fan or follower, and he sent his 9000 back a total of three times, hoping that Diesel would deliver finally a good rig. But last I heard, he was on his third 9000 where the transmit had failed, and I have been really touch base with him recently, but. Last I recall, he said that would be his final and last straw. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, comment, Dick.
Go right ahead, Mel.
Roger, on the 9000 series, my friend Woody, the same thing. He bought the 9000 figures that he buy the ultimate, and after going back and forth with him for also three times, he struck out. But, see, there again, as I had said earlier, dealing with a good dealer, you know, a good ham radio outlet dealer, they were very understanding, and he was very patient with it, and they traded the radio in for the ICOM 7800, which is the flagship of the ICOM line, and so far, no problems whatsoever. As far as like Yaesu is concerned with the 1000 series, I have a 1000 Mark V, and it had some issues with the receiver initially, and I had talked to Yaesu about it. They didn't seem to really have a concrete answer that seemed to, you know, more or less be confirmed that this was a characteristic of the radio. And I wound up, I did manage to change things around myself so that I more or less see that they confirmed it with their 2000 series, which they really took the 1000 Mark V, last of them, and twerped it into the 2000 series. So they do pay attention to amateur radio, you know, feedback. The point is that sometimes it gets a little outrageous. You know, with the radio that was close to like $13,000, I believe, that I think that's a little bit, you know, that should not really take place in this world of electronics, that there should be such, you know, problems. This, I think, is something the manufacturer is losing in their quality production pick over.
My goodness, I'm kind of amazed by these horror stories. I didn't think it was quite that bad, although you guys are concentrating on only the ones where significant problems occurred. I guess there could have been 50 good purchases and 5 not so good, and we're hearing about the 5 not so good. I top all of you guys when it comes to the amount of time I delay. Almost every piece of equipment I buy used. Most of the time when I buy it, it is an old enough rig that it's no longer in production. You're listening to a TS711A, one of my favorite 2-meter all-mode base station rigs, because I just like its particular front panel controls where I can rotate a knob that goes from 1 to 30 watts of output. So for transverters, that's very handy. Only has 30 memories. I don't think it has a scan function, but I believe this was a radio that was popular in the late 80s, so I'm 18 years or so behind the times, you could say. Doesn't bother me. I don't have to have the absolute latest. But I'm a VHF operator, and most of my radios are used on 2 meters, 432, or they're used as a tunable IF or a 10-gig converter or a 2-gig converter. So I'm not really using them on the original HF bands where they were manufactured. I got a Kenwood TS-520A, which probably is more than 20 years old. So I'm not the guy to listen to when it comes to the latest of rigs. But the one advantage you get when you buy something that old is that it establishes a long track record where a lot of people will tell you what they like, how long it lasts, and so on. You can talk to people who have owned the rig for 10 years and really tell you every possible which it ever had. My major motivation for buying equipment that old is not for reasons of reliability. It's reasons of cost. I can get something at a small fraction of the original cost if I'm willing to buy something that old. And where I have the ability to repair things, the wear out cycle doesn't bother me. I think you guys have heard the story before. The only rig I've ever had trouble with was an ICOM 450 all-mode rig. IC 471, I think it was. 471? I think it was 471, which had a whole production run where they didn't properly do a good job of removing all of the a solder flux from the printed circuit boards that went through the flow solder machine. So that very active solder was slowly crawling into all of the variable capacitors, eating up the bearing and making intermittent contact. And I fiddled and fiddled with that rig before I finally bailed out on it. That was the only real lemon of a rig that even for a person who has the ability to repair, it didn't solve the problem. Most other rigs, though, you buy something that's got a track record, and even if it develops a minor glitch, go to a tune-up clinic at Limark where Andy, WA2CDL, can fix anything. So with that as the backup, there is no such thing as a lemon, in my opinion. You can always get it fixed, with rare exception. So there's various ways of doing it. I'll admit that I'm lacking modern-day techniques like digital signal processing and all the possible IF shifts and so on. Although this particular rig, the Kenwood 711, does have IF shift, which is kind of handy when you want to emphasize the high notes or the low notes when you're listening to upper or lower sidebands. Lots of ways of different doing it, as you can see, Joe. KC2, QIW. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WJ2B with a comment.
Oh.
CUK Mobile with a comment.
Okay, Mr. CUK, yes, Bill. And J2B, Joe, go right ahead with your comment.
Want me to go first, Dick, or Bill?
Okay, I thought it was J2B, and are you not Joe from Wisconsin?
Okay, I thought you wanted Bill to go first. Anyway, I just wanted to throw my two cents in about the reliability on the radios. My experience working in the electronics industry for many years is that you know, when something new comes out, you can expect problems. You know, if you want to buy it right away, you can expect the complexity of the amount of parts in these new radios these days. You can expect the problem to crop up that you may have to send it back to the manufacturer at least once during its lifetime to get some issue resolved. And the other thing is, the smaller the rig, the more chance of having problems, especially on a transceiver, because the amount of temperature cycling that occurs in a small radio is much greater than a big radio. So you know, heating up the PC boards, cooling down, you know, heating them up on transmit, cooling down again on receive. So the temperature cycling does quite a bit of, that's how you excel through accelerated life testing in the quality control arena. So the small transceivers like the FT100 had many problems, the 706 had many problems. So those small radios tend to have their problems. So, you know, the bigger ones, not so much. But I know quite a few people that have had problems with the Mark V, the AC Mark V. So, any way you slice it, don't be surprised if at least once in its lifetime you have to have some type of repair work done to these newer radios with all the complexity on them. So that goes using WJ2B.
Thank you, Joe. Bill, my guess is in the process of you selling as many rigs as you have on all the flea markets you go to, you must have seen many hundreds of these rigs, some of which are old-fashioned, old reliables, and others that are quite glitchy. So what have you seen, Bill? WB2CUK, KQRIW.
All righty, Dick, KQRIW, and then WB2CUK Mobile. Well, it's one I'm using now. I don't remember the number of it. It's an ICOM dual band, or I think it's an ICOM. It has a problem when it's cold. It doesn't want to transmit. It'll transmit, but not full power. I had that a couple of times in the morning trying to get into the machine and wouldn't get in. But I have the 711 also, Dick, and I bought it new back in 1985. I think it was out probably a couple of years even then. I think that was probably the last expensive piece of gear I bought, and that's before I got married and I could afford it. But I've had nothing but good luck with that radio. I think once the power connector in the back, which I was using for something, to power something else has come loose, and I had to re-solder it. And all the problems I've seen in these radios is lack of solder. I had an ICOM 2100H I bought new, and after a couple of years, it started to act fuzzy. I was getting reports that the solder onto the power end was coming off. You know, it was like it was almost evaporating, maybe because of the heat. Like they didn't use enough of it. But yeah, I've seen a lot of them. And when I bought the 711, I actually went to the library and looked at some older QSDs to see about the specs and everything, and that was the reason I bought mine, Dick, and had, you know, a full 25 or 30 watts out, and built-in supply. We which I thought was, you know, I really wanted one I didn't have to use an extra supply. But I love my radio, and I'll probably hold on to that longer than any of my other gear. Take back to WBCUK, I'm over.
Hey, you and I are kindred spirits on that one, Bill. I love the fact that it's got a built-in 110-volt supply, so I can feed it either 110 AC or 12 volts. And it just got some awful nice features. It has a frequency synthesizer inside that is the world's best. I went and bought the service manual just to make sure I got the full schematic of how in the world they made a synthesizer so good. It moves in 10 hertz steps, and wow, is that a clean synthesizer in that TS711A. So Kenwood really went all out on that particular rig for its year, around 1983, 85 or so vintage. Boy, that was ahead of its time, in my opinion. It's also got this crazy DCS mode, digital code squelch, which almost no one ever uses, but it's built into it, some kind of a capability that no one ever used in the States that I know of, although I think the guys in California have used it. So there are some oldies but goodies. You talk to Mel, and he'll tell you of his great love of all of those Collins rigs. And I guess Collins rigs are more than 30 years old, and there are people who collect those. He's down to his last nine Collins rigs. He likes that brand name so well. But whatever turns you on, there's lots of different ways to enjoy this hobby, as you can see, Joe. KC2QIW for any other comments. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is KT2QIW, and the name is Joe, and yeah, thank you. Sorry about the background noise. Yeah, I like the big radios with the big buttons and the big knobs and stuff, and it seems like they're making them smaller and smaller and smaller, and I'm trying to find a mid-sized chassis, 8S or bigger, in under 1,000 price range, and I'm thinking about the FT 450 U2 on e-handling. They got a lot of great reviews. And alright, I'll pass it to the next station, and thank you for all the answers.
Maybe JTB an associated question.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
I was just wondering something about reliability of radios and electronic equipment. I was just wondering if you've heard anything yet through the grapevine about the effect of the Rojas initiative from Europe that got instituted last year, that they have to eliminate lead from solder and lead finishes, and that affected component reliability or soldering reliability that you've heard of?
Oh boy, has it. There are a number of military organizations right now that say that when you supply equipment to them, it will not be Rojas. Because they've discovered that in their particular environment, which is a little bit more severe, Department of Defense quite often is putting things into aircraft that go to high altitude with big temperature cycles, humidity cycles, and so on. And they discovered that the high tin content, I think it is, solders that are lead-free, will grow dendrites and create unreliable contacts and contacts that shouldn't be there. So there are organizations now that are starting to dictate that you will not supply them Rojas equipment. So it's real nice to say that you're making something lead-free and you're being friendly to the environment as far as what happens when the equipment gets disposed of and is leaching lead into the environment. But a similar thing happened with reference to Freon that's used for fireproofing. They haven't found anything anywhere near as good as the Freon. If I got it right, I think it's Freon I'm talking about that's used for fire extinguishing. They haven't found anything even close. Halon. Sorry about that. Halon. Halon is unfortunately a fluorochlorocarbon which does affect the atmosphere and the ozone layer. But they haven't found anything that comes close to that performance of halon and is friendly to human beings. So there are some cases where what sounds like new and great is not so great in the long run. So I'd be a little reluctant to buy a rig that brags about the fact that it follows Rojas requirements. When it comes to oldies and goodies, this one that I'm listening to right now, my Kenwood 711, I used it every single day of my life, so to speak, for years and years and years. And it did develop an intermittent one day where all of a sudden it would completely go off. And after a little bit of troubleshooting, I found out that the 110-volt rectifier diodes that are soldered into the main power supply from the circuit board, one of them developed a scratch, a crack. The solder developed a crack, and it was making intermittent contact. I just hit it with a soldering iron and replaced that particular solder, and been playing extremely well ever since. Which brings two things to mind. Whenever you do troubleshooting of a piece of equipment, modern-day pieces of equipment usually have 2, 3, 4, 5 different voltages inside with individual regulators and power supplies. Before you do any serious troubleshooting, go first to the power supply and measure all of those voltages. Because there are times when I have chased my tail where a reference voltage was low, which affected every other power supply and made them all low, and every single stage in the rig was low in gain, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I wasted an awful lot of time. So whenever you open up that cover to do any troubleshooting, measure all the power supply voltages first. Now, of our list of people who signed in, Aaron, you were the very next person who had a question, WC2C. So go right ahead, Aaron, with your question. Right after this, it's going to be Joe. Aaron, you got it. Aaron, WC2C, that's you just called away.
Okay, just making sure there isn't another Aaron. Are you referring to me and to RRA?
RRA is Eric, I think. I thought we did have a WC2C sign in, but I could have heard that one wrong. The next person with a question is Joe, WJ2B. So go ahead, Joe. I think you had a question.
Hey, Dick. Thanks. We'll bring up another subject, which is one of my favorites, and I know probably KEY's favorites too, is the full-wave loop antenna. I've been researching different ways to feed loops, and there's sort of, I think we may have talked about this before, there's a little bit of conflict how is the best way. If you're feeding it with coax, if you're supposed to have a current balun at the feed point or not. And I've seen a few people say that you shouldn't use a balun, and quite a few people say you should use a balun. And probably maybe the best way to feed it is with ladder line, but I'm kind of hesitant to run ladder line with a high-powered amplifier. So I was just curious if anybody had any comments as to their experience with full-wave loops, whether it be radio, 160, or whatever band there, to see best way to feed it with coax cable, or if you've had better experience with ladder line. So Becca, you think WJTV?
Obviously, Mel is the pro on this one, and in 30 seconds I'm going to be turning it over to Mel to give his opinion, so I'm going to tell you what I remember Mel telling me. Number one, he said it with ladder line. Ladder line, believe it or not, you may think it radiates. It doesn't. It's extremely well shielded. So running high power in ladder line is not bad, as long as there aren't people walking up to it and putting their hand around it while you're running the high power. Do something to make sure that people can't come in contact with it. But since he had the freedom of open wire line feeding his open loop, and because he's enough of a scientist that made himself a kind of an antenna tuner, where he could feed the ladder line fully differentially or fully common mode or in between. In other words, differentially, at one instant of time, the right-hand wire is getting plus 10 volts while the left-hand wire is getting minus 10 volts, and it's thoroughly balanced. They call that the differential mode. He had one kind of performance when he fed it in the differential mode. When he fed it more in the common mode, like putting 20 volts positive on the right side and 5 volts negative on the left side, that would be partially a common mode. A fully common mode would be to put plus 20 volts on both wires at the same time on the first half of the cycle, so to speak. When you do that, you're slowly sliding from the open wire line being a pure transmission line, and it does not radiate, and all radiation takes place from the loop. And as you start sliding over toward common mode, your transmission line is now becoming part of the radiator. And if your transmission line comes straight down, that means you've got a vertical component that you're radiating, as well as the horizontal component from the full-wave loop itself. On top of that, Mel has discovered that, well, maybe he hasn't discovered, but I've heard that when you feed it with coax, and you don't put a balancing device on the coax, current does flow down the outside of the lead, and therefore you are forcing a particular amount of common mode, which means that the transmission line coming down vertical is doing some of the radiating. Mel is probably going to tell you you've got full freedom when you feed it with ladder line, because now, depending on how you build and use your antenna tuner, you have the complete freedom to slowly slide from differential mode to common mode. And depending on the state of the ionosphere and who you're talking to and what direction, one mode works better than the other. And so this is a poor man's equivalent of a phased array antenna, in my opinion, where the four-wave loop does most of the radiating most of the time, but you can also use the transmission line as a, I'll call it an end-fed step or a top-loaded, a capacitive top hat type of ground plane antenna, with or without ground plane radials on the ground. Guarantee there's a lot of experimenting that can be done with this antenna. I'm taking some of the wind out of Bell's sail, but I'm sure he's got a lot more to tell you about this antenna. He has been experimenting with it now for at least 2 years that I know about. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I guess you're pretty much summed up on whatever I've accomplished. That took a lot longer than that to, of course, to accomplish the experiment. But basically, there are a number of different versions of the loop. A lot of people don't stick to the rectangular, you know, pure rectangular. They have a number of people gone through diamond loops and found that to be superior. In fact, there's a number of them that what they have accomplished is putting up a full-wave diamond loop and actually mechanically tilt the thing found that they have been able to control a number of the factors mechanically. In my case, the original experiment, like Dick said, came about that I put up actually, I put the loop two different ways. I had a feed line, open wire feed line, 600 ohm open wire feed line on one side of the rectangle. In other words, I took the, if you looked at it, it looked like two L lanes flat and being fed, each L being fed at a corner. And what I did, I brought that into the shaft, these open wire feeders, and I was able to, with my knife switches, and went back to something of the beginning of ham radio, really. That's the original PR switches, were actually knife switches. And I used that to, like Dick said, to do all kinds of configurations with it. And as far as basically what I wound up with, make a long, long story because we could take up the whole tech net in the discussion. We've had so many different discussions about this, type of antenna situation on, by the way, on 80 meters, I'm using 75 meters. Basically, I put it up so I could really make contact with my friends that are in Massachusetts, that are in Pennsylvania, that are in Virginia. I wasn't looking really for a DX antenna because basically the loop has always had somewhat of a reputation of being somewhat of a cloud warmer, which I find is not really true. Now, what I eventually wound up is I took the loop and on the side of the building where the shack is on the second floor of the house, but what I do, I have the open wire feed. It's actually dropping down. The loop is 45 feet in the air. I have this open wire feed now dropping down to approximately about 8 feet above the ground or so. I dropped down around 30 some odd feet, I'd say 35, close to 35, or 38 feet, whatever it is. I have it, tied off there, the open wire feeders, and I bring the wires back up in through 2 feet through the wall, which I've described. Basically, they're porcelain feed through that are used in oil burners, the porcelain pieces of material that are rods, actually, with a center iron rod. I solder it on the outside. They go through the wall, and then they go into a balanced input of using a Johnson kilowatt matchbox. Now, why did I select that? The Johnson kilowatt matchbox has link coupling in it, something also that was very popular in amateur radio back in the early days. Link coupling, I do not use a balance or any kind of toroidal matching network. This is direct link coupling. And I found also, like Dick was describing, that if I can bring the coupling so that I could, at times, create a situation, an unbalanced situation in the feed line, I can actually keep the signal in many cases. I actually can suit it, make it suit it to the situation. So it's very interesting, but almost everyone that you'll talk to that has experimented with loops have gone through open wire feeding. Very few have used coax cable because, as Dick just mentioned, the problem is using coax in a type of antenna of this type. So you're no problem with open wire feeders. I don't know why people have had trouble, you know, with open wire feeders, what the problem is with it, but I find that basically the only way to really get a loop to do what you think a loop should do. And so it's, I guess, was try, and talk, and everybody has come to this opinion that open wire feeders are the way to go. What else can I say about, basically a lot of people refer to what Dick said, that a lot of will say that the reason, they all say you got to drop the feed line straight down, and being that it seems to be a concise of opinion that maybe you're getting some vertical radiation type of pattern from the feed line at times and using the top loop as a top load, in other words, a reversal. Instead of having the vertical with the counterpoise down on the bottom, you have it up on top, the top-loaded vertical, basically. I guess that's the best way to describe it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, it does give you a lot more freedom when you build the right kind of a network to feed an open wire line into that antenna.
Mm-hmm.
And good common sense would lead you to believe that a full-wave loop, 30, 40, 50 feet in the air, horizontally polarized, whether it's like a circle, a diamond, a square, those are very minor variations. You would be led to believe that that antenna is going to give you the best performance by comparison to something smaller. And on maybe on one or two transmissions downrange, Mel will tell you that when he builds a tenth of a wavelength diameter loop and locates it on the ground or in the shack with him, just for receiving purposes, and he's able to, with that very small loop, which is, as I said, a tenth of a wavelength in diameter, he's able to rotate it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. He can pick up receiving signals and make the signal-to-noise ratio louder on the resonant loop in the shack with him than the full-wave loop 40 feet in the air in the backyard on reception. He hasn't done very much transmitting with it yet, but we all forget about the fact that on 80 meters, 40 meters, and frequencies like that, the signal that when it hits the ionosphere goes through a number of cycles of rotation, Faraday rotation. The ionosphere is a plasma, a conducting medium. It's got an Earth magnetic field. Whenever you mix plasma and magnetic field, you get Faraday rotation. You may launch the signal horizontally polarized from your QTH, and when it gets over to your buddy in England, it maybe has been rotated two or three times, from horizontal toward vertical, and it arrives vertical at his shack. And common sense would lead you to believe that if he sends vertical back to you, that you would get the strongest horizontal. Well, Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. The signal going east to west of the ionosphere may experience two turns clockwise, and the signal going west to east may experience 1.5 turns counterclockwise. It doesn't have to track. So to have polarization agility, whether it be horizontal or vertical, because of the way you change the differential versus common mode feeding of the open wire line to the antenna, or if you go the next step and have complete steerability of azimuth, elevation, and polarization because of the small loop in the shack with you, that's another whole area to experiment with. You do very little reading about the randomness of the Faraday rotation of the ionosphere for reasons I don't understand. It's very rarely discussed, and yet we're all experiencing it all the time. How in the world has that one stayed as dust under the rug, if you know what I mean? It's a whole beautiful area you're about to go investigate, so WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And one more thing, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, Joe just brought up one other question there about running high power. I've been running a kilowatt plus in the loop with no problems. I don't see why. This seems also, I've gotten a number of emails, I meant to mention this, questioning whether or not you and run a kilowatt or so into open wire feeder stick. Maybe you want to say a few words on that, over.
Yeah, the open wire feeder itself, when it's being used in the full differential mode, is as well shielded as a piece of coax. That's hard to believe. With the slight exception is that if you put your hand across it while you're radiating the kilowatt, of course you're going to experience some strong heating effects on your hand. So you wouldn't want to have it run through the schoolyard, so to speak, where the kids can go over and touch the wire while you're transmitting. But short of anything like that, a full kilowatt into open wire line is a very safe transmission line. It looks like it should radiate like crazy, and it doesn't look as well shielded as a coaxial cable. Properly used, it is, believe it or not. Back to you, Joe. WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2QIQ is coming.
QIQ recognized. Let Joe go first, and then we'll go over to you, Gordon. Joe, go ahead. I mean, Glenn. Joe, you got it.
Okay, Melon, thanks for the info there. I'm just trying to get a better handle on how the antenna is actually operating in terms of the commonality of the feeder and all that, because I'm feeding mine with coax, and we have about 30 feet of coax going up to the feed point, which is directly above my shack. And I'm trying to get it, I've used it on 160. A few of the people I talked to have decided to move to 160, being that the conditions haven't been too good on 80 meters. So basically, I've been feeding it as a open circuit, using it as a long wire on 160, and, I'm using the half-wave normal there. And it's been working out pretty well for me. I'm just wondering if there's a better method I can use in terms of maybe feeding it as a loop on 160 using using ladder line, or possibly opening the loop in the middle and putting a knife switch, dropping some wires down, like maybe lower it down, break the loop in the middle, put a knife switch, and be able to use it as a dipole, quarter wave dipole on 160. So I'm not sure if I want to do those experiments, but the way I'm using it right now is working okay, so I'm just going to probably continue until the weather gets a little bit better and do some more experiments. So thanks for the help, guys. Appreciate it. I'll turn it back over to you, Nick, WJTV.
Give me a couple more words on this one, Joe. You got coax cable going up to your full wave loop, full wave on 80 meters, half wave, I guess it is, on 160. Is the antenna conductor going to the left side and the shield going to the right side of the loop? Where you said you were end-feeding it, there's also the possibility that you just brought the whole loop together to one junction, brought that to the center conductor, and don't bring the shield anywhere. So how are you actually connecting your coax cable to the antenna? Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, that's correct. The feed point of the splitter, the coax cable, goes into one of those little white doodads that has two screws on each side. It's not a ballon, it's just a coax and two screw terminals. And basically just one side of the shield of the coax goes to one wire and the center conductor goes to the other. My loop is in a triangular shape. And I have six ferrite chokes clamped onto the outside of the RGA, right where the connector, starting from the connector down. So I have a current ballon made out of the first 6 inches of the coax. So that's how I'm keeping the RF off the shield, coming back into the shack and giving me all kinds of problems. But what I do on 160 is I have a fairly extensive grounding system. So the amp, radio, tuner, and the rest of the equipment is all grounded with heavy gauge wire to a water pipe outside. And a water pipe in the house, and also a copper pipe driven about 9 feet into the ground right near the shack area. So I have a fairly extensive ground, and I'm feeding the loop with just the center conductor on 160. What I do is I disconnect the, unscrew the shield and just have it back, onto the insulated part of the coax, and just have the shield, just have the center conductor making contact on the SO239 in the back of the tuner, and then I'm able to tune it to work on 160, and then I run is about 500 watts on 160 to be a little bit cautious, but it seems to work okay on 160 with that method there. Back to you, the WJ2.
Yeah, I've got another question for you there, Joe, and that is, what kind of standing wave ratio are you getting with the method you feed it on 80 meters and the method you feed it on 160, roughly what kind of standing wave ratio are you getting before your antenna tuner has to correct all that? Back to you, Joe.
Okay, you let a lot of people tune it.
Yeah, one more quick comment, then we'll let you go to the other people. It's probably about, it's resonant around 3995, the antenna. I get about a 1.2 to 1. I've been using it on 3826, which I have an Ameritron tuner, an ATR30, and I have to bring the SWR on 3826 without the tuner is about a 5 to 1, somewhere in that area. So I use the tuner to match it. And the SWR on 160 is probably about, around the top end of 160, it's probably around 15 to 1, something like that. I could probably give you better measurements maybe next Sunday or a little bit later. While you're talking to other people, I'll make some measurements with my the MFJ antenna analyzer. If you want to know the exact impedance, go over to the other people there. So I'll sign up WJ2B.
Very fine, Joe. Thank you for that information. Glenn, KC2QIQ. I know you wanted to add some comments to this. Go ahead, Glenn.
Hey now, what are you checking?
Yes, sir, guys. I've had some very good results with loop antennas, and one of the methods I used to feed it was with ladder line. That was actually the best way, but how I did it, because I used my single loop for three bands, 160, 80, and 40 meters. And how I did it was I basically cut the antenna length of the loop for approximately the 80-meter band, the lower half of the 80-meter band, using a 4-to-1 balance right at the antenna, and using an MFJ 269 antenna analyzer, and looking at that length where I got my best possible match for the lower half of 80. And then I clicked over and looked at 160, and 160 actually had a nice, a little bit narrower bandwidth, but still fairly decent, and also looked at there again over at 40 meters right at the antenna, and I actually had three nice low PSWR conditions by putting the balun right there. Then what I did was I removed the balun, ran the ladder line along the side of the house, and then moved the balun just where the ladder line entered the house, and then ran coax from the balun directly over to my antenna tuner right by the radio. There, because I just found I had a little bit better shielding with the coax coming in as a little neater arrangement, and now I'm able to use the antenna really on three bands with very good PSWR and very mild tuning with the antenna tuner.
Sounds like a nice arrangement there, Glenn, how big is your loop, and you got a big enough piece of property in Massapequa to contain all that?
Yes, I don't have the exact measurements on it, but it's roughly about 270 feet round, and it's fed directly with ladder line right where the two halves come together. I run the, at a high point off of the house, I run the ladder line down along the roof line, and in fact, just where it comes in onto the second floor, and the balun is just behind a little, piece of like aluminum diamond plate where I actually have the balun mounted, and I terminate the twin lead right there and then run the coax in. So, and the loop antenna isn't very high. I only have it mounted roughly about 5 to 6 feet off the ground. It follows a picket fence around the yard and then comes to a high spot in the house, and the antenna basically works as a vertically polarized antenna on the three bands.
How about that? A lot of different ways of doing it. Joaquin, did you say you wanted to make some comments on this? WP4KXX, K2RYW on the tech net?
No, I was just checking in there, Dick. Whiskey, Bravo 4, Kilo X-ray, Eastern Suffolk County.
Okay. Your audio is a little bit high for this repeater, but sounds good. I thought you had something to add to all that was going on here with reference to loop antennas. I wonder if Aaron has come back, because I think he did check in with a possible question. WC2C, are you there, Aaron? K2RIW in the TechNet? Looks like Aaron really did get called away. Okay. Of all the people who signed in, have I skipped anybody? Have I missed anybody? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2EWK for a comment.
Go right ahead, Eugene.
Okay. Is it true on 60 meters, it'll be 45 feet on each side of the antenna? Is that true? And what size bound do you suggest using for that when you use coax cable?
I think you did say 60 meters, meaning 5 megacycles. And 5 megacycles, 60 meters, would be the 180 feet for full wave. Half wave would be 90 feet, if I got those numbers right. I think so. The 90 feet antenna, 45 on each side. 45 feet on each side, half wave, should give you something close to 72 ohms impedance. Therefore, 50 ohm or 70 ohm coax should feed it very nicely. What Joe did by putting the 6 ferrite toroids on the outside of his coax cable in the vicinity of the connection to the antenna, that made a beautiful balance, which stopped any RF energy from flowing down the outside of the coax. Another way that a lot of guys have done is to take the coax cable and make 3, 4, or 5 turns of it and tape it together, those turns of cable, a foot or two in diameter, near the feed point, also acts as an RF choke to stop RF current from flowing down. So 45 feet each side of center should be a beautiful dipole antenna on 60 meters, and you may not need an antenna tuner. You may not need anything more elaborate than those two different kinds of balun that we just mentioned, Eugene. You could be quite pleased with that antenna. W2EWK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you only go 4 to 5 turns. Now, how thick would that be? As a coax box, or as a can of, say, 5 inches, or how thick do you want me to go?
Make those 4 or 5 turns a foot in diameter or more. That gives you a real RF choke at that frequency, Eugene. So it's about a foot in diameter and held together with tie wraps or electrical tape. And so that's one way of making a balun right at the feed point. Another way is by putting a number of these toroids over the outside of the coax cable itself, 4 or 5 of those. That's what's actually inside many of these commercially made balluns. If you took them apart, that's what you would see inside. If you put no balun at all and just connected the semiconductor to one half of the dipole and the shield to the other half, the antenna would work quite well. It has a little bit of current flowing down the outside of the coax cable, and in some cases, that's not bad. It doesn't just... some guys, depending on the length of the cable, end up with some RF in the shack, but not very many do. You can start off with no balun and add the balun later. Back to you, Eugene, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. I will use 4 to 5 turns a foot, and so I figure that'll be like a coax box, you know, coax container. Okay, thank you very much there, Dick, and happy holidays to you, and I hope Teddy Cross brought you everything that you want, and Teddy Cross brought me an HT1250 Motorola, and I'll tell you something, I had so much fun with that radio. No intermod. I also have Yates Motorola 1000, no intermod. So the Motorola's are... make me very, very happy of the commercial use, and I love it. At night, before I go to bed, I kiss my Motorola because I'm so happy with them. So I guess I'm pretty happy. Okay, thank you very much there, Dick. W2EWK. Plus, I'm not married. That's another reason why I can stick with Motorola. So I'd rather have my radio than a girlfriend or a wife. W2EWK, clear.
My goodness, is that a testimonial? Wow. That's a man who really likes Motorola handy talkies. Glad you're so happy with them. Glad they're working so well. The Motorola handy talkie that Owen Garriott was using on the space shuttle way back in 1985, and he connected it to an antenna that was taped to the window of the space shuttle while he was flying over the United States. and he talked to a number of radio amateurs. Boy, did he get wall-to-wall intermod. But he was in an extremely high location, looking at a 2,000-mile diameter of humanity all at once, and he needed a pre-selecting filter. The people who tested that radio before he went into space made sure it didn't emit any signals it wasn't supposed to, made sure it had good sensitivity, but they weren't quite smart enough to put all of the signals in there simultaneously that he's going to see from that catbird seat. So Motorola in the past has had some trouble with their handy talkies having intermod. And part of what's going on there is that a handy talkie, the main thing you and I want is long battery life. And the way to get long battery life is to make sure that the receiver, when acting in the receiver mode, doesn't draw a whole lot of current. Well, there's a conflict of interest there. If you want the high intercept point amplifiers that don't have intermod, you have to pour some current into them. That fits bias up to a reasonably high current. And that's opposite of the philosophy of having long battery life in the receive mode. I guess the right approach would be to have the radio have a sleep mode where it really is off, you know, 5 seconds at a time, goes on for a few milliseconds to see if there's any signals there, and then goes back off. And it only draws current when it's really receiving signals. But an ordinary handy-talkie, my IC2AT, for instance, draws only 20 milliamps in the receive mode when it's squelched. But I guarantee you, with so low a current, it can't be very intermod-proof. I wonder if we have Paul on frequency tonight who can tell us about what's going on in space. WS2N, are you there, Paul? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Also, Dick, I get a magazine that is called RF. I'll spell the word to you, D-E-S-I-G-N. And they got a lot of filters in that magazine that you won't believe. A lot of filters for commercial radios, WCWK.
Yeah, with a good pre-selecting filter, that helps a lot. I think Paul may not be with us tonight, in which case I'll turn it over to Mel a little bit earlier. And Mel, one of those guys at the Kings County Radio Club been doing this week. Have some of them put decorations on their tower. We do have a guy out in Suffolk County who does that. He's got 100 feet of tower and he puts all kinds of fancy lights on it. And I think he even puts a sign, a vertical sign that says Merry Christmas. Wonder if any of you guys do that. And I bet you've received some mail in your mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WHSCDL, just quickly.
Okay, stand by, Mr. Mel. Andy, I mentioned your words are... Your call letters earlier. Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, I just got on. I gotta leave because I'm doing some stuff. But I just wanted to know if you received your QST issue for January, and if you did see the article that we mentioned last week regarding stacking antennas, which was a good article.
Which was in the World About 50 Mags by Gene W. WS3, I can't think of his call letters right now. You know the guy I mean. Yes, sure did, and I'm kind of happy about that. Glad you brought it to my attention so I knew right where to look. And the whole idea of what's the right stacking distance for Yagis when they're on the same band, which is one stacking distance, and Yagis that are on different bands, where you can stack them a lot closer, that's a whole area that's not well understood by many VHF amateurs. A little bit controversial, but a number of people have followed my advice as to how close they can stack them, and most of them have been happy. One of the classic cases was John Fandel, when he was living in Levittown, had an array of 8 Yagis on, I think it was on 2 meters, and 4 Yagis on 2 meters, 8 Yagis on 432, all stacked together on the same bed frame, so to speak, and doing successful moon bounce on both bands, where you could say that the 432 Yagis were buried in the middle of an array of Yagis on 2 meters, and very little interaction, worked very well. He was running that antenna on the horizon at times, sweeping it in azimuth. I was recording signal strength and therefore plotting his antenna pattern, and his antenna pattern of his 4 Yagis on 2 meters was exactly What it should have been is just the 432 Yagis weren't even there, and vice versa. Each of his antenna patterns were doing exactly what it was supposed to do. They didn't even see the other antenna. And that's all explainable. How are you doing with your tower, Andy? You're not letting winter slow you down on putting a bunch of antennas, are you? W-A2-CDL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Right. All right, Dick, fine. Well, I still have the antennas to put up, quite a few. And today is actually an ideal day. You know, they always say that, you know, there are such things as diehard amateurs that pick the coldest day, the windiest day, the rawest day, the snowiest day to put up antennas. And today's no exception. Although the temperature's in our favor, given that it's around 60 degrees. But the truth is, a little bit too windy today to play around antennas. Although I'm waiting for a break in the weather and I'm going to do something about that. Okay. I have to run, but I'm happy you received the QST and saw your call mentioned. And really good on the stacking. It's something that, like you say, is all something that we don't know much about. And the article is a very good one. I'm going to have to run now, Dick, because I want to finish up this job here. And I will catch you next week, and we'll go from there. So, in fact, I have something else to mention, but it'll be next week. We'll wait. Stick back to you, and I just really have to run, WHCDL, and we'll talk to you next time. Speak to you soon.
Yeah, we've gone through all of our questioners tonight. You could give us a hint as to what the subject is, if you wanted to, Andy. Your choice.
Yeah, definitely. I want to have a discussion about square law and what that really means. Because, basically, given a diode and how a diode behaves with an input signal, an RF input signal, the output voltage and how it's proportional or non-proportional to the RF voltage in the diode depends on the level of the RF voltage that's applied to it and what kind of diode it's applied to. And there are different types of detectors, and one is called a square law, which I think is the mathematical term of how the diode rectifies the voltage at what reference level.